Hello, and welcome to the Marketing Times Analytics Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Safranis, and today I'm on with Jonathan Baker. Jonathan, would you like to introduce yourself?
Jonathan Baker, I'm one half of Punctuation, which is a small advisory consultancy that works with small to mid-sized marketing services companies, ad agencies, PR firms, digital firms, and I handle the mergers and acquisitions side. So deal with valuations, benchmarking, and then sell side by side searches.
That's interesting. The selling and buying of companies in the marketing ecosystem.
That's correct.
Yeah, that's interesting. How did you get into this? What was your career journey like?
It was not typical, but I doubt there are many typical. I started doing marketing strategy consulting, did that for 5 years, then left the corporate world to start a brewery and ran the brewery for 10 years. Now I've got two business partners running that day to day. But one thing that happened along the way, we had a potential buyer poking around and I became really fascinated with the M&A process and saw a chance to work with the other half of Punctuation, who happens to be my father, David C. Baker, to help build out this part of the program. So I've been doing that for 4+ years now.
Oh, very interesting. So can you explain from a high level what the M&A process looks like?
Sure. So in this particular field, it takes probably 6 to 12 months on average. It starts with getting a valuation done, developing marketing materials, and then going to market, which is effectively like dating. You're just having lots of first conversations with potential buyers. Some of those will hopefully progress. You'll get to a point where one of them will give you a letter of intent, which basically gives them a right to negotiate with you exclusively for the next 30 to 60 days. And then once the letter of intent is agreed upon, due diligence will happen, which is similar to due diligence on a house, and then hopefully you'll close.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess there's a few different places I could go here. This podcast is brought to you by Adverity. Are you struggling with marketing reporting? There is another way. With Adverity, whether you're working across 10 or 100 different marketing channels, you can effortlessly manage all of your marketing performance data in a single location to make reporting as easy as clicking a button. The Adverity solution also scales with your business, so as your business grows, the tool grows with you. So remove the stress of reporting and book a demo at adverity.com using the link in the description. Thank you. And now, back to the podcast. I'm curious, how many deals have you personally done in the M&A space with marketing companies?
Yeah, so our firm has done about 140, and I've had my hand in probably 20 or so at this point.
Nice. Okay, and from an industry perspective, would you say M&A activity has increased among marketing, I'll just say marketing companies overall, or how have you seen the trend happen over the last few years?
Sure. Activity was really strong 2 years ago. Once interest rates started going up last year in 2023, I think that cooled a lot of the activity. And in addition, a lot of the marketing firms that we have worked with had pretty soft Q1s, Q2s last year, which kind of kicked them out of the market for the whole year. Through the summer and fall of last year, it was really slow. And then it has started to pick back up in the winter of last year. And it's actually been really interesting because now it seems like we have more buyers than we do sellers. So it's a great time to sell. Multiples aren't what they used to be a couple years ago. They're still a little bit depressed, but I'm not sure if or when they'll ever get back to those kind of 2022, 2023 levels.
And if you're advising a company that wants to sell, at what point should a company be sold? What would you say are some indicators that they're ready?
A lot of it comes down to the people. Age is a good indicator if you're nearing retirement age. And I would say just personal drive, gas in the tank would be a good indicator too. Running a professional services business where you've got sometimes little chance of recurring revenue can just be a grind. And sometimes it's the right time to get out just because you know that it can only go downhill. But on a more positive note, I think once you pass $1 million in EBITDA, which is pretty similar to net income in our field, then you start seeing the buyer pool increase. You start seeing multiples increase. And if you can maintain or grow past $1 million in EBIT with strong margins, 20 to 30%, I think that tells even more about how you run your business. Those would be two indicators that I'd look for.
That's interesting. And then is there any difference when you're talking about the buy side? If somebody is considering buying a company, what should they be looking for from that company for a good investment?
Yeah. So if it's for a good investment, you're looking for something a little more specific. You're looking for a company that has, that's got strong senior leadership, because you're going to lose your founder. A company that has a strong business development process in place. And it's a process that you could basically just pour gas on, right? And increase the number of leads pretty soon after acquisition. So I'd look for those two things primarily if I was looking just as an investment. But a lot of these buyers are not necessarily thinking about these investments as investments. They're thinking of them as ways to cross-sell their existing clients, or ways to shore up a weak data analytics department that they have, a way to break into the U.S. market if you're in Eastern Europe. A lot of these are more strategic acquisitions, and the reasons can really vary depending on who the buyer is.
Where do you see the most demand right now in terms of buyers? What kind of move are they making when they're buying a company in this space?
I think right now you've got a lot of demand for digital firms and performance marketing firms, SEO, SEM, less SEO, but areas where you can have strong retainer clients, where you're just rolling them over month to month, and where you can easily track the success of what you're doing for clients. I think those are some pretty hot areas right now. Although I will say that doesn't mean there's no traction in these other categories. There seems to be pretty strong demand across the board right now.
That's good. And how do you see that playing out in the future? The M&A volume, let's say, for these marketing companies, do you think it'll increase over the next few years?
I do. I think once government figures out what it's going to do with interest rates and people can feel a little bit more secure about borrowing power and the state of the economy moving forward, you'll start to see more sellers enter the market as well. And then you'll have more debt buyers coming back on board. So I also think the pandemic in 2021 really took the wind out of a lot of folks' sails. And I think there's some, for good reasons, owners out there who don't want to put themselves or their firm through something like that again, and we'll be looking to exit just for more kind of personal health reasons.
Yeah. What are some of the biggest risks to an M&A transaction going through?
The biggest risk I see is loss of a large client, but buyers will hedge against that by only giving a certain percentage upfront, and then the rest is contingent on hitting performance targets. People think of the risk of losing employees as a large one, but I rarely see that play out. I think employees actually, in many cases, are better off now that they have more upward mobility if they're getting rolled up into a larger group. And if nothing else, they're willing to give the new regime a year or so to figure out if it's going to be a good fit. I think, yeah, losing a big client would be the single largest risk, and also largest risk to the sellers in trying to achieve their earnout goals.
Yeah, and can you explain more about how these deals are typically structured in terms of the payment? Because that you mentioned something interesting, that it's only a fraction upfront, and then the rest is contingent on the continued success.
Yeah, so in marketing services, this field, I would say an average deal, and you've got deals on both sides of this, remember, but an average deal would be 30 to 50% in cash up front, and then the remaining 50 to 70% in an earnout structure, which would be over 2 or 3 years, equal payments made as long as you are hitting certain performance targets that you have agreed to. So that could be growing top line revenue. It could be maintaining a certain profit margin. It could be retaining a key client. You can get creative there, but those are some of the more common ones.
And when you say losing a key, like a big client, are you saying after the transaction happens, the big client says, I don't want to work with this company anymore, and that's why the deal falls through? Or is it like, at what point is the big company even finding out about this and possibly leaving?
Yeah, this wouldn't be a reason the deal fell through, because it would usually happen after the fact. If it's a very large client, you might tell them right before just to give them a heads up, but otherwise they're going to find out afterwards. For whatever reason, if there are conflicts of interest, or they don't like working with the new staff, or they just no longer want to work, they want to work with another smaller shop again, there are many reasons a client could leave, and that is the largest risk to continuing payouts.
So let's say that the second half of the deal doesn't go through. So the first, there's cash up front for a portion of the company, but then the revenue, let's say there's a miss on the revenue target because, let's say, a big client falls through. Does that, what happens to the deal?
Depends on how it's structured, but there are instances in which nothing happens. The seller gets $0 and has effectively given up half of the company for free. Better case scenario would be if you have negotiated so that it's not like an all or nothing cliff. And if you get 90% of the revenue target, you get 90% of the earnout, and 80% and 80%. And so that would be a way to protect yourself a little bit against not being able to hit targets.
Yeah. And I'm assuming you work with a legal team to work out the structure of this, or who do you work with to figure out the best?
Yeah, usually we'll be the ones working on the terms at that level. And once we have those agreed to amongst both parties, that's when we would work with a legal team and a tax advisory team to pretty up the documents and bring it to fruition.
Do you ever have sellers who ask for too much, or maybe even too little? How do you agree on a good selling price for a company?
It's a good question. And one of the, yeah, we have actually adopted our process in order to address that exact concern. So we will do evaluation for a company first, and then walk them through the valuation and talk through, okay, if this is what we think your firm is worth, this is what we think we can go to market for, but I would just expect that we'll get negotiated down to this. And is this something you're comfortable with? Is this an achievable, or a target that works for you, because this is what we think is achievable? And if at that point we're too far off, it's no hard feelings and we can part ways. But that's a good way for both parties to make sure that we're on the same page.
Yeah, that's great. Why did you get started in entrepreneurship?
I think entrepreneurs can't really help themselves. There's no real, I just have always had ideas and wanted to make things work better. And I started my career as a consultant, and it was incredibly frustrating being the one looking at their business and making suggestions that I thought would make the business better, and then seeing nothing happen. And an entrepreneur wants to do. And I think that's when it dawned on me.
Yeah. And if you were to reflect on the difference in how your career turned out versus what you might have expected in the beginning, what were some of the biggest differences in how everything unfolded?
As an entrepreneur, I certainly have more control over my time and the things that I focus on, but I also have more worry and fear trying to keep all of that safe. And it's I don't think it's too dissimilar from what I expected. But as an entrepreneur, you have to keep forcing your mindset open and make sure that you are continuing to grow and learn and listen to people with humility, or else you're not going to be able to get better and get your business to a better place.
Yeah. On that note, what were some of the biggest growth moments or biggest challenges you faced in building your business?
I think recognizing that I'm not as good as I thought I was at some stuff and seeing talent in certain areas that I just don't have and being able to align myself with that talent. I've got two amazing business partners who one is more of an operational guy. The other is more of a finance guy. They're both better at those two respective things than I am. So acknowledging your faults and humbly solving for them, not thinking too far ahead in one sense is something I've learned to do. So in another sense, you have to think 3 to 5 years out in terms of like broadly, what are you shooting for strategically? But if you've got a roadblock right in front of you and it could play out a number of different ways, but you won't know until, you know, so-and-so returns a phone call or you have a meeting or whatever, there's no use worrying about things that are out of your control. Wait till you have as much information as you can before you start to worry and make decisions.
Yeah, that's really good feedback. Good advice.
You have to be able to compartmentalize in a way that I didn't anticipate, particularly if you're managing people and you're going from one meeting to the next, and one you're having to have a really hard conversation and let someone go, and then the next you're trying to give really encouraging feedback to someone who's, you know, just feeling down in the dumps. Like you've got to be able to shift your frame of mind quickly.
Yeah, that's tough. So I guess I'm going back to the M&A deals. I'm curious, what does the timeline look like? What's the fastest deal that you've ever done, and what's the longest one?
The fastest would probably be 4 months, I would say. The slowest, these things can go on indefinitely, really. But if something drags on for longer than a year and a half, I would say it's unlikely that it's going to happen.
Okay. Yeah. And how do you, do you market these deals? Let's say a seller comes to you. How do you get the word out to potential buyers about that company?
Yeah, so we're fortunate that we've built up a newsletter list of 15,000 marketing services firm principals. In addition, we have built up over the years a database of active buyers of these types of firms. So those are two of the methods that we use immediately. And then a third is really just dependent on the firm itself that we're trying to sell. And we'll do customized research to try to find buyers that we think fit the right profile. And there's no like secret to that. That's just hard work.
And how often do you get a buyer from the email list versus the research?
I would say that most of our buyers do not come from the custom research, but the research might help inform future deals. At this point, we've developed relationships at some level with a lot of these buyers, and so we can speak a common language and be honest about what each side wants, and there is value in that.
Would you say that what you're doing is similar to real estate? These are high ticket transactions. You're negotiating between buyers and sellers. Maybe a better question is, what is a parallel between the work you're doing and somewhere else in a different industry? Are there any comparisons?
I've tried to think through this as well, and I don't know if there's a great comparison. Real estate's not a great one because of the personal nature of these deals. And a piece of land is a piece of land, and sure, you might have some memories on it, but a business that you have spent years of your life building and developing and whose primary asset is the people that work there, there's just a lot more emotion and feeling wrapped up in the deal. And so in that way, it's like a marriage, finding a spouse. but not with the negotiation of real estate. Although real estate, yes, you can get creative, particularly on larger deals. Not a ton of creativity on smaller deals in real estate, though. And I would say the inverse is perhaps true in our field.
Yeah. So do you see the marketing industry, all of the different advertising, PR, and so forth, a general consolidation happening between companies and continuing, or do you see more fragmentation happening in the future?
It'll be constantly a battle between the two. So you've got firms that grow, sell to larger firms, then you've got entrepreneurs that are working at those larger firms getting fed up with how large the firms are, want to do their own thing. They start their own firms, grow those, sell them. So it really is a cycle that I see continuing at a pretty steady rate.
Okay. Yeah, because I was talking yesterday about telecom and how that industry is just so, it's like very consolidated. That's like the name of the game. It's like really hard to fragment that out, especially just because of the nature of it. There's such a big tech investment, and there's just a lot less competition. But I feel like in marketing, we'll always have a lot of competition and a lot of local players, especially when it comes to different cultures and geographies. It just naturally has more built-in competition. So that makes sense.
Yeah, and the barriers to entry are just so low. You need a laptop. That's all you need, and an internet connection.
Yeah. If somebody was to start a marketing or some kind of any agency or any sort of services company that you would oversee that you've seen bought and sold, what would you say is the easiest one to start to get to a point of sale right now?
Right now, I would choose an industry that is large ticket item. That could be electronics, it could be tech, it could be B2B tech, it could be medical services, and build a very specialized kind of lead generation performance marketing firm that only serves that industry.
Okay. So it's definitely something where the more niche you are, the better your chances are going to be to find a buyer that's interested in your company specifically to beat out the competition.
Exactly.
But not in terms of function, not niche in terms of functionality, because you're saying performance marketing, that's quite broad. There's a lot of different tactics that could fall into that, but you're saying the industry it serves to be very niche.
It could be either. If you think about the buyers of these types of firms, it's usually going to be larger, less specialized agencies. And so what they're trying to buy in many cases is your expertise or your access to a particular type of client. And so that could be a vertical industry niche, or it could be a horizontal, very specific piece of performance marketing, for example.
And following that example, how would you hire a team to build value in the company in the biggest way? Would you hire people who are veterans in the industry? Start with that. Would you, or would it depend on the founder? How would you think about advising that?
Yeah, you want to hire for your weakness, right? So that strong you can be together, but you also certainly want to hire for cultural fit. And usually that means cultural fit with the founder. And in my experience, cultural fit is actually more important than your resume and your experience, because a lot of that can be learned on the job, particularly if you're a curious person. So I would say definitely not industry veterans. They're used to having teams underneath them. They're used to a certain level of bureaucracy. And right out of the gate, you're not going to have any of that. So you're going to need people that are like-minded, that agree with kind of what you're trying to build and can do a lot of different things reasonably well.
But that's good. That's encouraging. And how do these companies that end up being sold get funded in the first place? Are they often a bootstrapped business? Do they have loans from banks to build the business? What type of funding do you typically see with them?
They're almost always bootstrapped. Very rare to find significant chunks of debt. And if you do, it's often related to purchasing the business. So it could be an SBA loan that's on the balance sheet because the new owner used that to help fund the purchase.
Okay. Yeah, it makes sense because there isn't, in the services industries, there isn't a lot of upfront investment.
No, there really isn't. Yeah. And I feel like it's less and less every year, the way that the cloud has changed things. And now you don't even need a physical space. People are very understanding of remote work. There are just fewer and fewer barriers for new folks to jump in.
Yeah. And so when a company, you said a lot of the time people are hiring for expertise or access to the clients. How often are they hiring, how often are they looking for technology, like intellectual property that belongs to the business? Is that typically a piece of the deal that's valued, or is it more the founder and the deals?
So if the selling company has valuable IP, it is almost always valued and considered a part of the deal. But a lot of these folks don't have a ton of like real IP. For IP to be valuable, it has to have proved its ability to generate profit in some way. Yes, and there are companies that have built out unique technologies, and particularly if those are specific to, I would say, a vertical industry niche, then that's going to make that company even more valuable to whoever's trying to purchase it.
Makes sense. Yeah, this is very interesting. So how do you find companies that want to sell their business?
That newsletter of 15,000 folks is a good place to start. We put out a lot of free content so people can learn from us, grow with us, and also get a feel for how we think about things. And then we have a separate advisory side of the business where we help firms work on their positioning, service offering design, lead generation, roles and responsibilities within the organization. And all of that work eventually will lead some clients to sell. And oftentimes it's repeat clients.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So you're helping companies with branding as well to make themselves a little bit more marketable.
I wouldn't say branding. We are very bad at that. But the idea behind the brand, what are we going after? Yeah, that's what we help with.
Oh, more strategy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting. Is there a lot of competition in the M&A marketing space, or have you carved out a niche here?
There is competition. There are probably three or four other groups that work in this space with any regularity. And then it's not a particularly complex industry in terms of the way a business is run. And so it certainly doesn't prohibit other M&A folks from getting involved. There's definitely some particular ways that this industry talks about the work and the finances, and some things you need to watch out for in terms of clients and principal compensation that are unique, but it's all learnable. We do specialize, and that is what I think has helped us along the way.
Yeah. I'm curious, when you're valuing a company, do the results to the client matter in the deal, or is it more the number of clients and the value and revenue metrics for those clients?
It is not the results of the client, no. It's the latter, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. You would think that the company's pitch to the client would somehow influence it. If you had a company that was like really good at client management but didn't give as good results, and they might actually have a better valuation than a company that is worse at client management, maybe doesn't have as many clients, but has really good results for those clients.
Yeah, it depends on what you mean by results, but I think in a lot of ways, these firms are also consultants to their clients. And so they are not responsible for implementing these recommendations, decisions. And there's so much political nonsense, bureaucracy, that it's just really hard to know if good work is actually always getting to the top. It's likely not.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, marketing is very political. I think especially now because there's just a lot more money flowing into it than ever before. There's more places to advertise. There's more ways to advertise. There's more data. The industry is just growing so much. Yeah, and there's still so much politics around even how to value marketing, depending on the tactic. How do you attribute the results? So it makes sense that that's on the marketing firm to figure out, but the buyer cares more about what are the results in terms of clients that you have.
Yes, and profitability of those clients.
For a company that's the most profitable, what characteristics would they have versus a company that's less profitable from a sales perspective, like when the company's being sold?
If I understand your question correctly, and interrupt me if I'm answering the wrong question, they would have a strong sense of their own value and not be afraid to charge what they are actually worth. They would have strong internal processes so that time and effort isn't wasted. They would have a strong perspective on what an ideal client looks like and what a bad fit client looks like. And they would not take on clients that they think will be or turn into bad fits.
That's interesting. Yeah, and I guess the inverse is probably true for the low profit margin companies, is they're undercharging, taking on any client, and so forth.
The challenge with the underperforming agencies is there's just so many reasons why it could be underperforming. And so you really do have to dig in to figure out if it's a problem you could even solve. And that's why these companies often are not getting great valuations, is because there are just so many more question marks for a buyer.
Oh, I see. Is there ever a case where there's an easy solution that the buyer sees to fix the problems at a company and they can leverage that to get a better deal? They could say, for example, your profit margin is very low. I know I could improve it. You might not have the ability to improve it right now, so I can get a discount on this company by buying it with that issue.
So usually the discount would already be factored in at that point. And if the solution is really that obvious, the seller might not want to give full credit to the buyer for the difference as well. There are very often are easy solutions to some of these problems. If you're a small company with a ton of overhead and there's a larger company that can absorb your HR and accounting, project management functions, and knock 30% off of your costs, then that feels like a win.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, like if the selling company had a issue with lead generation and volume, and the buying company had a lot of customers they could cross-sell to, that could be something where they have a point of leverage over that company where it would be more successful with the buying company.
Yeah, exactly. And in that case, you might be able to propose a deal structure that involves the selling company retaining or rolling over some of their equity into this larger entity, so that lowers the purchase price for the buyer, but it also gives some of the potential upside to the seller.
Yeah, is it usually an all or nothing deal where 100% of the company is sold, or is it typically a share of the company?
Yeah, I would say the most typical is all or nothing, but there's a decent chunk that involves some form of equity as well.
Okay, yeah. Makes sense. Yeah, this is great. I've learned so much. Can you share your newsletter? Is there a way to get onto your newsletter?
Yeah, absolutely. It's if you go to punctuation.com, you can sign up for the newsletter right at the top of the fold there in the purple box.
Awesome. Thank you again, Jonathan. This has been so interesting, and I really appreciate you joining us today.
You're welcome. And we have a little website set up for listeners of your show. So punctuation.com/MXA, Marketing X Analytics.
Yeah.
And if anyone wants to get in touch, talk further, happy to help.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jonathan. All right. Thanks everyone for listening. We'll talk to you soon.